This is XTP Media.
You're listening to Extended. Your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 60 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, I'm joined by Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society, and Tim is the Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine. Tim, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Hello, everybody.
Now, today's episode focuses on previewing some air shows. We'll talk about Air Day 2016 as we get to talk to the team behind the air show and the challenges they face in putting on this spectacular event. We also get to talk to Lewis Gaylard about his latest book on the Sea Vixen called Sea Vixen XP294, the inaugural year with the Flight Navy Heritage Trust. Of course, most of us know her as Foxy Lady, of course. Along with feedback and promoting aerospace, this show is, of course, as always, fully loaded. So let's get started by finding out what's been going on lately. Tim, you've been across to the US, haven't you? And you've been across to France. You've been a very busy guy.
Yeah, so this is the traditional media kind of pre-Farnborough media visits that you get invited to, and just for companies to go and tell you, give you an idea of what they're up to, what the latest news is. Bit of background briefing, and then when you go to kind of Farnborough and they've got the big news, then you've got an idea of, oh well, yeah, that makes sense, and that you know it gives you good background information. So we had the Airbus Innovation Days that was in Hamburg. So looking at what was happening there, big story to come out of Airbus really was they've had a really challenging first part of the year. They've had problems there with the engines, the new Pratt & Whitney engines for the A320 Neo family. They need tweaks. It's a new engine. It's the geared turbofan. It promises it's delivering really, really good performance. But there's a bit of a glitch in the startup time.
Yes, according to Qatar, they're not very happy, are they?
Yeah, so Qatar Airways is not very happy. And they've had a real problem in trying to get these aircraft out. And simultaneously, the A350, their flagship twin jet, is the answer to the 787. Again, huge demand, really, really quiet aircraft, you know, lovely to fly in. And they've only delivered at the moment 9 so far.
Yeah, it's
half the year gone, and their goal really is going to get 50,
right?
Delivered by the whole year. So a lot of that was kind of focused on the production processes,
yeah,
and sort of solving the problems. And the A350, bizarrely enough, has been delayed by things like toilet doors.
Yeah, and they're having supply chain problems, aren't they, Airbus? And of course, we saw the well-documented supply chain problems with the Boeing and the 787. What are Airbus doing about it?
Well, I mean, you know, the part of it is kind of trying to work with suppliers and stuff. So we're going to kind of help you to get to our standards. Part of it is threats. we'll progressively get rid of you. And I think, you know, maybe part of it is that they're still not kind of it still hasn't maybe sunk in to, I'm not talking about the kind of big suppliers here, tier one or tier twos, but maybe some of the smaller ones, it still hasn't sort of like sunk in as to the the pace that Airbus wants. You know, this industrial. It's not quite a Japanese car factory of bang 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 bang, but it's that sort of thing that they're it's no longer as Tom Williams, chief operating officer, says. You know, aerospace is going from like what was an artisan type kind of craft industry where people, you know, kind of crafted, you know, handcrafted aircraft, to this thing where it's going to be repeatable and it's going to be fast. That said, the airlines are themselves, at least in the A350's case, I don't think some of the blame maybe can be assigned. It's not just Airbus's fault or the supplier's fault, or airlines do change their minds and they do things, leave things to the last moment, especially where interiors are concerned. So, you know, if you've got people changing sort of design, interior designs at the last moment, you've got everything almost ready, that is going to throw a spanner in the works. Even though this time, compared to the A380, Airbus has tried to make it much more simple and much more modular, so they can come. You know, you can go in. I went to that actually their cabin design sort of showroom design house in Hamburg. You know, amazing place. A hangar full of 10 sort of fuselage sections where all these different sort of styles are kind of put in there.
Yeah.
And you could.
Tim, does anyone buy just off the shelf or all? I mean, I know, when you're talking about tens and hundreds of millions of euros, dollars, and pounds worth of aircraft, you want it to be just right. But is anyone buying off the shelf? And is it, you know, is there a bog standard fit that either gets the aircraft a bit cheaper or a bit faster? I mean, they've got 3,000-4,000 plus to produce in the pipeline. Well, you know, I mean, something's got to give.
Yeah, I mean, for the for something like the the A320neo, you might have all economy class neo. There is there's going to be something maybe different coloured seats and trim.
Yeah,
it's going to be pretty easy. A little bit of branding. The problem is, I think, when it comes in when you have a wide body and it's always the first class cabin the airline wants to make its own stamp. So again, they're trying to make things easier. They're trying to make things like these different style predetermined styles where you can tweak it and you can future fusion or pick something else or something. Yeah. Passion or something? I don't know. But anyway, these sort of like predetermined styles, and then you can mix and match some of the colours and some of the looks, and also lighting, the LED lighting. That's a real boon in that you've got these 256 million colour LED lightings you can have in the ceiling. And obviously, you look on the pictures, and everyone's got the rainbow version. You know, just to show you how kind of garish it can be. but what it means that can do is that's a really, really easy and cheap and simple way of an airline having its branding. You know, you've got a colour scheme there. That there you are. It's light. We don't have to change anything or put different fabrics in or etc. So, yeah. So the interesting question on that is, are they going to make it? Let's say 41 aircraft to deliver, A350s. Could be some very unhappy A350. Sort of customers. I think on the Neo, they've got a little bit more give in that it's still only a fraction. I think it's only a small sort of fraction of the Neos. The rest of the CEOs were to be delivered in the rest of the year.
And Qatar, we mentioned them earlier. They were going to be the launch customer. They rejected the aircraft, and there was talk of them potentially cancelling the order. I know we've seen hijinks from them before, but do you think that's realistic? I mean, if they go to Boeing, they'll be the end of the queue, surely.
That's a very good point. Yeah, I think there's two things. Obviously, three things. Obviously, Akbar Al-Baker, he drives a hard deal. He's got plenty of clout, and he does like speaking his mind. He's not going to go and beat around the bush. One of the things obviously is compensation. He'll be in line for. Two is he was talking about switching to the alternate engine. The CFM Leap 1A. There's a possibility that maybe he can switch his order to that. Again, that's going to involve slot juggling.
Or
the third one, and that obviously this is the nuclear option, as far as sort of Airbus is concerned, is right, we're cancelling all our orders, we're walking out, we're going to go and buy Macs. And I'm sure Boeing would fall over themselves to go there and snatch that order up, and you know, they would make sure he would get his slot somehow.
Yeah, and Tim, also looking ahead to Farnborough, there was talk of a A350-1000 possibly making an appearance. I mean, as we record this today on the 17th, time's running out for them, isn't it?
I think, you know, weirdly enough, they've got it out of their hangar. It's sans engines and sans paint. They would have to do a few first flights, pretty sharpish, in order to be able to get it over. But there is a, you know, weird and intriguingly, there is a space mocked out for it in the Farnborough sort of static display. and you think it's not a brand new aircraft. It's not a new type. It's a development of the A350. So, in terms of maturity, it could be that a fairly short few flights around the Toulouse area, and they would be confident enough to say, well, you know, this is effectively an A350. We are good to go and do a longer flight, and if that longer flight happens to coincide with the Farnborough Air Show,
yeah.
We can do it.
Right, okay.
But looking increasingly unlikely at the moment.
Okay. And you also have been across to Arizona, haven't you, to Boeing?
Well, yeah, I mean, again, this is with Brand X, but looking with the military side of things. This is a little visit to their Mesa factory, which does the Apache and... AH-6 Little Bird, small gunship.
Yep, great photos, by the way.
and also Jacksonville to see the US Navy, where that's their main P-8 Poseidon base. So very, very interesting in both places. The AH-64 line, down the E-model,
yep.
Digital model, it's fully spec'd. It's, the crew can actually control drones from it. And it's even maybe armed with lasers in the future.
Right. Okay.
Special Forces wants to sort of trial a directed energy weapon on it. And then over in Jacksonville, there is the P-8 training. So it's the main base base for P-8 Poseidon, U.S. Navy Poseidons. Very, very strict security. Took us a long time to get in. Very, very privileged to be allowed on the base in the first place. And then sort of shown... their simulators, their mission train simulators, their maintenance simulators, and a great talk with VP-30, who is their main sort of, it's the fleet, I'm going to get this wrong now, fleet replenishment or fleet replacement squadron, anyway, the main training squadron for the US Navy, both in P-3s and P-8s. Interesting thing about that is they've got about 12 Brits there on the squadron, as well as some Australian crews coming through.
Right, okay.
Because Australian has bought the P-8 as well.
So, Tim, the decision from the UK to buy the P-8, it takes some time to organise some of these things. We've seen, of course, in the press this week about the formality of the order going through. Having crews out there means that probably things were in motion a little bit in advance of that.
Well, we have to remember we had the Seacorn project, which was basically to all the Nimrod to keep the RAF's hard-won maritime patrol experience through Nimrod and to spread these sort of aircrew out with allies, you know, sort of so down in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and obviously the US Navy. So that has kept a core.
Yeah.
A core of skills going, and also, I mean, the US Navy guys were saying to me about, it's not just been one way of, we'll let the Brits have a few sort of slots in our training squadron and keep them happy as an ally. They've been actually learning things from RAF aircrew, because you know, Nimrod is a swept wing, you know, it was a swept wing jet aircraft and does air to refueling. And the P-3 did do air to refueling. So they've got somebody, they've got two of their people there, RF guys, have said, we do air, we've done air to air refueling in Nimrod, you know, what's the big deal?
Yeah. Right, okay. So should we have a look at what else has caught our eye in the news?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, it's been a very sad month for air displays. Blue Angels, the Thunderbirds in the United States, the Russian Knights in Russia, and of course in Holland we saw the Swiss F5. Gosh, so many all at once, Tim.
I mean, that was it's just unbelievable, really. If the you know, two on one day, and then a few days later, two on another day. You know, obviously, these things do happen from time to time, but to have them concentrated in such a short space of time, and the bizarre sort of statistical anomaly of, you know,
and diverse countries, diverse aircraft, you know, in all parts of the world, it surely is just coincidence.
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't think you can sort of say it's you know, the linked in any way, but it does sort of raise you know, maybe for the general public about, these you know, maybe these display teams are, I would say, sort of, I mean, a bit more dangerous than they thought they were.
Yeah, and of course we'll talk in a short while of the impact of last year's events here as well. But let's change topics entirely, and let's go up towards the stars. Elon Musk. I think most people know who Elon Musk is. If you haven't seen the Falcon 9s shooting off and coming back to land on the barge, you've missed out. And this very, I think it was yesterday, they had a bit of a... not a disaster, but a bit of a challenge on one of them that came back. But the big news, and of course we're all looking towards the autumn now, is for the announcement that Elon Musk is going to make on travelling to Mars.
That's right. So and he's been hinting that for a while. He was sort of hinting that when he came to the Royal Aeronautical Society and won a gold medal. If he gets to Mars, yeah. I don't know what we're going to give him after that. We're going to have to invent some kind of new kind of...
He is just very cold, though, isn't he? I mean, come on, he's just Tony Stark. He is Iron Man.
So he's great. He's talking about getting the dragon to Mars, the unmanned dragon. Okay, so that's, he's talking about getting that on the planet in 2018. That's kind of... very clever, really, because it's you know, everybody's sort of thinking, well, why is he mucking around with reusable rockets, you know, blasting stuff off, and then this rocket is coming down through the atmosphere at something like, you know, massive sort of speeds, and then trying to land on a barge, you know, why not just kind of have it come down on parachutes or you know, dispose of it, you know, reusability be stuffed. And then you look at you put two and two together and you say, ah, okay, right, it's to get down in the, you know, and the capsule as well has got a sort of a safety mechanism, the Dragon capsule, the manned one. It's got kind of, you know, retro rockets to get it clear, like the its version of the escape tower on the Apollo. And again, you know, that's a way of getting down the red planet.
He has to get it up first, though, and he's got to get the Falcon Heavy flying first. And I think we're expecting that later this year, I think, from memory, which, of course, is the heavy lift rocket in the portfolio. That'll be interesting to see that fly. And like most things out of SpaceX, you know, we can expect some possibly some failures, but they will persevere and they will get it done, but they have to get that flying first. So 2018 they have to go for because of the orbital mechanics, don't they? The shot at Mars has to take place in 2018, and the next one I think is 2022-23, where potentially the manned mission could be.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of sort of bits of the infrastructure to come into place. You've got the Falcon 9 Heavy. You've got the Mars Colonial Transport, whatever that is. You've got the Red Dragon. But then what he's talking about is, so 2018, you put an unmanned Red Dragon, and then 2 years, every 2 years, another cargo ship turns up and lands on Mars. And then he's talking about, and this is the incredible thing, that will be put enough infrastructure, enough supplies in place for a manned mission around about 2024, 2025.
It's amazing, isn't it?
So that is, you know, I mean, you talk to NASA or talk to ESA, and they'll sort of say, well, you know, maybe around the 2030s. And here you have a private company that says, no, actually, I can do this, faster.
Yeah, he is amazing. He is amazing. Well, let's move on to some more news back here. We've mentioned Farnborough. We've got the Royal International Air Tattoo, and shortly we'll talk about Air Day as well. Let's look at Farnborough then, Tim. What can we expect to see? Everyone's intrigued by the F-35, of course, but what else is there going to be that might whet the appetite?
All right, so well, the big news this week, and I confess that I might have something to do with in letting people know about it.
Yes. You did break this story.
It's the Red Arrows not doing aerobatics at Farnborough, and then this is one of the knock-on effects. So obviously, Shoreham and the CA looking at air show safety and tightening up the rules and regulations. So what's basically happened is that Farnborough have tightened up their regulations. They made a substantially reduced display zone for aerobatics. There are also other things like they're going to kind of clear roads underneath, even a canal underneath, apparently, from sort of people, sort of spectators, and also monitor pilots' performance with a electro-optical tracking system. All good stuff, except the RAF has had a look at this, and they've looked at it and they've realised there's no way they can modify the Red Arrows aerobatic display to fit within this new zone. It's very dynamic, it's very high energy maneuvering, and obviously there's 9 aircraft there, and they split up and they come back. You want to deconflict the 7 from the 2 as well and keep them apart while you're doing this sort of stuff. The Red Arrows are obviously known for and like other display teams, is there's always something going on. If you watch some of the display teams, who go off and they come back a bit, and by then the crowd's lost interest. Is the Reds have always been known for, there's something to keep your eye on, something to watch. So I think that is, the decision is that the risk holders had to take, in the RAF, and obviously they've got now the Military Aviation Authority that looks after safety, and they looked at that and thought, well, this space is so sort of tight now, if God forbid something did happen, it would inevitably mean third parties on the ground who were killed. Now, obviously there's been a bit of a backlash. People are very disappointed. People have paid for tickets. Farnborough has been very disappointed as well. A lot of sort of negative comments. This has happened, and sort of health and safety gone mad. But what we're talking about here is we're not talking about kind of probably paying punters who pay to get in, but it is that something, a part of an aeroplane or wreckage or something, ploughing into people who are just going about their you know, daily business in Farnborough.
Outside of the field,
in aircraft at all, and you know, bits of a hawk come crashing down on them. That's the thing now, that we live in a new sort of situation with post-Shoreham, is that we've got to look and think about these things, you know.
We've seen Throckmorton go in the last week, which is very sad. I know Gareth wanted to talk about that. By the way, Gareth is on his way. He, as many of you know, he has a rather challenging job that is very unpredictable. He is on his way. He may join us. We hope he does. But if not, he has made every effort to be here. He did want to talk particularly with us about this issue. But we've seen four other air shows as well of various shapes and sizes go. Is this the beginning of the end, do you think, Tim, for the British air show as we know it?
I don't think so. I think with Farnborough particularly, it's significant in that when these were brought in, and the rules were tightened up, you know, everyone thought it was going to, okay, it's going to affect the small shows like Throckmorton, you know, and private flyers with their, you know, vintage jets. That was the intention. So it's a kind of law of unintended consequences in that the, you know, the RAF's own aerobatic display team, highly professional, can't now fly their usual aerobatics display at the UK's biggest aerospace trade show. So, you know, that is sort of significant itself. However, the Reds aren't going to be flying at Farnborough. They're going to be coming in. There'll be a sort of formation fly past with F-35. F-35 is going to be flying. There might even be a formation fly past with A400M, A350. They're going to be doing a lot more outreach actually on the ground. So if you've got kind of kids who want to meet the Red Arrows, want to get their signatures, you know, at the weekend, that is going to be, you know, and there's going to be still a stuff flying there that is kind of you know, sort of make up for it. So
yeah, Tim, Boeing's centenary. Yep. 100 years of Boeing. What are Boeing planning to do? Any insight into anything exciting we might see?
Well, they're gonna have their own sort of centennial pavilion. So there's going to be the 100 years of aviation as told by Boeing. There's also going to have a lot of Boeing heritage types. I think Dave Holmes was talking about, you know, why is there sort of a T6 or Harvard a Boeing heritage aircraft. Well, obviously, it was North American got bought by Boeing. So, you know, it's like Douglas and Rockwell, you know, it comes under their umbrella now. So there's going to be, you know, things like that, B-17. There's a 727 there.
Oh, fantastic.
747-8 freighter.
Okay.
So there's got lots of Boeing aircraft to see, as well as the first appearance from 737 MAX. So this is the only air show you're going to see, the first air show you see the 737 MAX and the Neo go to head-to-head. So it is going to be significant from that sort of point of view, yeah.
Right, okay. And, of course, Tim Peake is on his way down. Is there the slightest chance Tim Peake might make an appearance at Farnborough?
I've got no insight into his sort of like, you know, post landing plans.
Yeah.
But having said that, the previous Farnborough 2 years ago, he was there doing you know, kind of outreach. I think he was actually taking part in something that the society might have been involved with in the maybe it was the Futures Day on the Friday. So
yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think you're right.
You know, again, just speculating here, I have no insight, but if I was the UK Space Agency and I wanted to kind of keep the momentum going and, you know, get, obviously, kids, you know, he's managed to, I mean, there was some stat he tweeted out today about reaching 1 million school children.
Yeah.
You know.
Fantastic job he's done.
If he turned up on Futures Day on the Friday, the place is going to go mental.
Yeah. He certainly is very popular.
So I don't know. You know, it depends on what, you know, sort of, you know, like I say, no special insight into that. But if he turns up, he's going to get an absolute hero's welcome. The place is going to go nuts.
Okay, let's leave Farnborough then for the moment. Royal International Air Tattoo is almost upon us. Anything exciting? Are you going to that, Tim?
I have been going there for one of the days. Well, Riyadh is going to be interesting this time for got the all five F-35s. So five aircraft are coming across the. Atlantic, and three F-35As from the USAF and two F-35Bs. Obviously, the B is the Stovall variant. It's only going to be the B that is going to be displaying at Farnborough, but you're going to have all five there at Riyadh. So that will be sort of worth seeing, all five F-35s. There's also a strong contingent at Riyadh this year of German aircraft. I think we've got a big turnout from the Luftwaffe. So that should be good as well. And there's always kind of things that kind of pop up from time to time. That are sort of last minute sort of bookings or that get announced. Yeah. So
going to be another good one.
It should be a really good one. Yeah, like I say, a big turnout by the German Air Force.
Right. Okay. Well, then, just before we leave news and things that have caught our eye, in the UK, we recently saw the 90th birthday of Queen Elizabeth, and of course, there was the fantastic flypast over London. Sort of slight dichotomy on that one, thinking through some of the points we talked about flying over built up areas there, but I'm sure for the Queen anything goes. But it was fantastic. Don't know where did you see it, Tim? Were you live or on telly?
Let me see, was I live on telly? I think it probably was on telly at that point. Yeah, come back from the a press trip there, so I think it was just.
Yes, you were. Yeah, you were. Well, I was out at Compton Abbas. Of course, we talked about an episode or two ago. Saw it there. Fantastic event run by the team at Compton. So thank you to Emma and Laura there. We got the Battle of Britain Memorial flight. We got the Spitfire and the Hurricane that actually flew over Compton. Fantastic. Did a few passes, some turns. It was amazing because Compton's very small, so you get very close to them. There's some wonderful photographs. I then had to send you a message because I wasn't quite sure what was up with the Spitfire's wingtips, and I'm very embarrassed that I never knew the answer. And for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, I sent a message to Tim to say, what's up with the Spitfire's wingtips? They're square.
So, you thought maybe you kind of stolen them in the night and...
Yes, I thought something was up. I was like, oh my God, what's going on?
Yeah, so obviously the Spitfire evolved over the course of World War II, and one of the things it came up with was the story of the Mark V model is that they came up against the FW-190, the Butcher Bird, and these had their wingtips clipped at the end, and that improved roll rate and low altitude performance, because obviously the FW-190 has got a really kind of quick roll rate, and it was a real sort of shock at the time that the Spit had come across the Butcher Bird. So that's why the clipped wing is. So they kept on it with on it, and so a number had still had these LF versions,
Yeah. Oh, well, I learned something new, and I hope everyone else did there. I was also lucky enough, while we were there, to see the Swordfish as well, returning from a display. They did a fly past as well. So that, for me, was a particularly memorable moment, as I think it was Simon Wilson flying the Swordfish back to Yeovilton. They detoured as well to Compton. So very, very lucky for us. We saw the fly past on the TV and then got our own little display. So if you've got any fly past stories you want to post, tweet us or send us a message on Facebook. Dave Homewood, he sent us a question and said, why wasn't Lancaster up?
Okay, well, they had that... now I'm racking my brains now. It was an engine... A glitch.
Yeah, and they had the engine fire, didn't they?
That they were fixing, and obviously that sort of working on that. And I think also there was some decision to do some sort of some maintenance, perhaps of the fuel tanks. I think as well, and so I don't know whether it was going to do it early or something on those lines, and that's why there was no Lancaster at the flypast.
Right. Okay. Well, let's leave it there. We're going to come back very shortly to talk about Air Day 2016. There's still lots to come with Get Involved and promoting aerospace. But after this break, we're going to talk to the team behind the Yeovilton Air Day. I get first to start off with Commodore John Pentreath, OBE. He's the commanding officer at Royal Naval Air Station Yeovilton. First Commodore for me. We also get to speak to Wings, that's Commander Henry Mitchell, our very, very good friend, Lieutenant Commander Chris Gotka, and finally the commanding officer of the Commando helicopter flight, Captain Niall Griffin.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
I'm with Commanding Officer of the Royal Naval Air Station Yeovilton, Commander John Pentreath, OBE. John, welcome to Extended.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be talking to you.
Thank you very much for your time. It's very precious. I want to ask you, what does Air Day mean to the Fleet Air Arm here?
So the Air Day at Yeovilton is a huge day in Yeovilton's calendar. We open our doors to about 40,000 visitors and try and show, not only give them a good time in terms of an air display, but show them what we do here at Yeovilton as well.
Yeah.
So it's a huge event for us and for the Fleet Air Arm generally.
Yeah. And how can we encourage some youngsters to come through those ranks and start to come to these? There's been a lot of negative press about air shows. How can we positively promote the Fleet Air Arm?
Well, I think you just have to come and have a look, really.
Yeah.
You know, the theme for this year is past, present and future. And you know, the future is clearly the youth of today.
Yeah.
And the Fleet Air Arm offers a fantastic opportunity for them. We've got all of our types in the Fleet Air Arm, types of aircraft. We're renewing them at the moment, yep, transferring to new types, and they will be around for the next 20 or 30 years or potentially longer. So, you know, the helicopters are the old ones are going out of service, the Sea King 4.
Yeah.
We retired a couple of months ago, being replaced by the Merlin Mark 3, which will turn into the Merlin Mark 4,
yep,
as it gets modified over the next 2 or 3 years. The Lynx, which has served the country so well on frigates and destroyers and in the army,
yeah,
for some 43 years, I believe it is. We say goodbye to that next year. And we've already got the Wildcat, its replacement, coming in, which is just the most amazing machine.
Yeah, it's exciting times, really, for the Fleet Air Arm.
It really is exciting.
We've got the F-35
coming. And we've been trying very hard to get the F-35 to fly this year as our air day, but I don't think we've achieved, yeah, that, sadly. but it will be here in every future year, I anticipate. And so, yeah, the opportunities are fantastic, whether you're flying or interested in engineering or just want to support it in some other way, logistically or all sorts. So there are, you know, hundreds of careers. We definitely need, you know, the youngsters to be interested. And coming to something like Air Day is a great way of seeing it.
Yeah, and we're surrounded at the moment by some fantastic historic aircraft, and we hope to see one or two of those flying. You've got a great display lined up for Air Day, a lot of foreign players, but we're going to see the end of the Lynx, as you mentioned there. And last year, Tracy was telling me, the most successful Air Day ever, 40,000 people.
It was, I think, the most people we've ever had. It was a beautiful sunny day, which clearly makes a difference, and a good display of aircraft. Last year, probably the Vulcan, which is one of its last displays, drew lots of people. But, I mean, this year we got some iconic aircraft, the Sea Vixen, for instance, a 1960s carrier aircraft, is now the largest and heaviest vintage jet flying since the Vulcan retired.
Okay.
And that flew last week, hit from here at Yeovilton for the first time this season. And you know, his test flight for the first flight was from here down to Culdrose in Cornwall and back.
Wonderful flight. I'll bet many Fleet Air On pilots and ex-Fleet Air On pilots have made that journey.
I think so. We've got clearly the Battle of Britain Memorial flight coming and the Lancaster coming, we hope, this year. So and lots of other vintage aircraft, historic aircraft. Then the current crop of military aircraft, you know, as we say, led almost by the Lynx this year in its last year flying here.
It's sad to see it go. It's just it is iconic. It never started that way. But.
No, it's been a fantastically successful aircraft. But the Wildcat, which sort of unhappily for Wildcat, looks just like a Lynx from the outside. Really, I mean, the enthusiasts will spot the difference from the outside. Inside, it's completely different, and the capability is just amazing.
Yeah.
And so that's good. Typhoon coming to show the sort of you know, modern fast jet, and then the future is things like Wildcat and the Merlin in the Commando role. So the Jungle Assault, for instance, which is the traditional finale of Yeovilton's Air Day, will be full of Merlin Apaches coming down. So it's, you know, past, present, and future, I think, is a good strap line, and people will see all of that.
So an exciting display we're going to see. Let's just talk a little bit about HMS Heron. What's the future for Yeovilton looking like?
So Yeovilton, the future is extremely bright. There's been a lot of investment because of the new aircraft coming in, and so we are a core defence site, and I can only see Yeovilton getting bigger, to be honest, over the coming years. It's one of the few... few defence sites. Sorry about the noise in the background, but we are in a frontline hangar. as the defence site sort of contracts generally, we're trying to put more into the sort of core sites, and so I think Yeovilton will only increase in size.
Well, that's fantastic news. Commodore Pentreath, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. A pleasure.
I'm with Commander Air, and that's Commander Henry Mitchell, otherwise known as Wings. Commander Mitchell, welcome to Extended.
Thanks very much.
Can you just tell us a little bit about the arrangements for the show? You're in control of all the flying on the day. What's your role in preparing for flying for the day?
Well, preparation starts shortly after the previous Air Day last July, where we identify any lessons learned and then amend the procedures required for the following year. And there were very minor adjustments. And throughout the build-up over the course of the year, then we put in place all the appropriate people, security arrangements and contractors, and put out our bids for flying participants as well. So that takes place over the whole year.
Yeah, and an exciting lineup for this year's Air Day that we're hopefully going to see very, very soon. You've got some international participants. What sort of challenges does that place upon the air station and your role coordinating their activity?
Well, the primary requirement is that when they come to the UK, when a foreign participant comes to the UK, they have to be validated by the flying display director of the first show that they attend in the UK.
Right, okay.
That then suffices for the Military Aviation Authority as a validation for subsequent shows.
And could this be their first show of the season, and therefore who would do that validation?
It could be their first, and if it is, then I will do it.
Right.
So they'll come a day early and then do their fly their display, which is already approved by their own national authorities, and then just validate it. It helps them obviously orientate themselves for the particular geography at RNAS Yeovilton. But as we are 1 week before the Royal International Air Tattoo at Fairford, some of the participants will be flying at Yeovilton as well as Fairford.
Yeah.
And it's a combination between the Fairford organisation and me at Yeovilton will determine who is best placed to do that validation. In some cases, it might be one of us goes abroad to that foreign nation's country to do the validation on their home territory, and that suffices, and then they can come straight in and perform at Yeovilton.
Right, OK. And last year, we saw some very sad events that have had an effect on many air shows in the UK. Have they had any effect on Air Day?
The aftermath of Shoreham initiated a Civil Aviation Authority review into the whole air display regulatory set. That has taken place over the last 6 to 8 months. Because we are regulated by the Military Aviation Authority, then we aren't specifically required to address the amendments to the CAA regulations. But over time, the MAA regulations and the CAA regulations are becoming much more harmonised, and therefore there is a spillover from the CAA's review into the MAA regulations. For me, there haven't been any major adjustments. The MAA had a slightly different set of regulatory requirements.
I think it's fair to say they're a little bit more stringent than the CAA's. I can say that maybe.
Well, I would agree, but then the MAA's and the military's requirements have basically been founded on much higher energy maneuver aircraft, and much more expensive aircraft. They require more altitude, more space to maneuver. And that's really the direction that we've been coming from.
Yeah.
The CAA over history has obviously flown and authorised a large number of aircraft at the lower end of the aircraft categories, you know, the Tiger Moths, the Gypsy Moths, building up to Spitfires, Hurricanes, and far less orientated around the higher energy fast jet type community. But of course, over time, more military fast jets, ex-military fast jets have come into the circuit. And I think it's fair to say that the regulatory set has been amended in order to cater for that better than it perhaps did prior to Shoreham.
Right, OK. So what sort of challenges do you have as Wings and Commander Air on the day, managing a very disparate set of aircraft, fast, slow, helicopters? How challenging is that, getting the mix right?
Well, what we want to do is provide a spectacle for the crowd so that it mixes up the fast and the slow and the helicopters and the vintage and the large and the small. And parachutists generally will jump at lunchtime when there's a little bit of calm and quiet for people to eat their sandwiches and grab a burger. So we try and put the display together, which keeps people's interest. That entails a number of considerations. Some of the vintage aircraft, for instance, can't start up for too long and be held on the ground because their oil overheats. Other aircraft are flying in from elsewhere and have a time on top that we need to meet and make sure that all other activity is on the ground. We have passenger or helicopter pleasure flights flying throughout the day, but some of the displays require them to be on the ground. For instance, the Red Arrows will require all the airspace around, so the pleasure flights are on the ground before they arrive and then carry on with passenger flights after they've left. So there's all that sequencing. It just needs to be very carefully thought through to start with, and barring any either unserviceabilities with the participants or weather factors, then it should be able to run pretty much to time, with the couple of adjustments if somebody has a slight hiccup on start and builds in an extra delay of a couple of minutes. That, of course, cascades down through the programme, and we just need to be ready to adjust and perhaps cut short a display, or possibly even take a display out in order to keep the timeline going and not extend the day unnecessarily.
It's a busy control tower then. I'm sure you're up in the control tower. You're very calm and collected here. Does it get pretty energetic in there?
It's not really. We've got, I'm the flying display director. I've got a flying control committee coordinator. We've got the senior air traffic controller, and then the team of air traffic controllers in the visual control point. And then down below in the air traffic control tower, we've got the radar team as well. So they are monitoring for stray aircraft that are flying into our airspace. The worst case, we'd have to stop a display in order to prevent any conflict with an interloper. But otherwise, get on the emergency frequency and warn them off and hope to steer them away. But really, just to keep the airspace sanitized, there is a what we call a RAT, a restricted airspace temporary, which is imposed by the CAA for the hours of the air display. So that should be known by all aviators through the NOTAM system. So they should know that it's going on, and they should avoid it, but you can't always guarantee that everybody's either read the NOTAMs or know quite where they are when they're flying. So the radar team should look after that warn us that there's another aircraft in the airspace. But by and large, it's pretty calm. Everybody's doing their jobs. And it focuses the attention.
Okay. And in the past, I think last year, we had the small drone, the unmanned vehicle, doing some videography as well. Is that, how does that fit in? Is that given strict guidelines of where it can and can't be? Or how do you manage that in the show?
We did. We haven't actually got it this year. That's for no other reason than we thought we'd give it a rest, but there's no regulatory requirement or concern that prevents us doing so. But we, like the pleasure flights, there are certain displays that where the pilot would prefer to be for it to be on the ground, and in which case it was still on the ground. Other displays where they it at no stage did it impinge on altitude with the displays, but if there was any concern, we'd put it on the ground. But otherwise, we'd keep it effectively in a column of air, would go up and down the crowd line, outside the crowd line, within that column of air. So at no stage was it overflying the crowd, but it just gave spectators who are interested in unmanned air systems or model aircraft an idea of capability and looking at some of the video footage. But it is important to stress that nobody else is authorised to fly model aircraft within 6 miles of the air station, and they'd be infringing the regulations and conducting illegal activity if they were.
Now, we spoke very briefly before last air day. It was one of my most favourite displays. Obviously, we saw the end of the service of the Vulcan. The French were here. Great display as well. It really, really went well. What are you looking forward to in this year's show?
Well, we don't have the Vulcan, as you pointed out, but we do still have the Sea Vixen, and that's got a new lease of life, and that's restricted at the moment to a fly past only as a result of Shoreham being a civil registered ex-military fast jet. In due course, I'm confident that restriction will be relaxed, but whether it is in time for our air day, I can't possibly determine. That'll be as a result of other CAA deliberations. But it'll certainly be flying. And, of course, we had the Norwegian Heritage Vampires, which were a great addition to the combination of the Vulcan being led by the Sea Vixen with a Vampire on either wing. But we do have, instead of the Norwegian Vampires, we've got the MiG-15. Which they tried to get here last year, but they ran out of pilots. They had enough to get the Vampires here, but not the MiG-15. But we'll park that once the MiG-15 has finished its display. We'll park that alongside the Sea Fury, representing the iconic situation where a Sea Fury in Korea shot down a MiG-15. So there'll be an opportunity for a photo the two aircraft together. That's with the military registered Sea Fury here at Historic Flight, which is a wonderful looking machine. and pretty much at the top end of the old propeller-driven aircraft before we shifted collectively to jets. We've got a Seafire with a French R coming back, absolutely, and that was a very popular display, as you say. We've got, we're just confirming numbers at the moment. We think we've got three Rafale coming, one of which will be a spare, but in the fly static park, and the other two are expected to do a display. And that's always a good illustration of French flair, and a wonderful illustration of the naval aviation, which of course we operate alongside. And when the new carriers are back in service, we will be operating on a regular basis alongside the French.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, and very best wishes for the show.
Thanks very much.
I'm with the commanding officer of the Royal Naval Historic Flight, of course, Lieutenant Commander Chris Cock, AFC. Chris, welcome back to Extended.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Chris, it's been a busy winter for you. Tell us about some of the developments.
Yeah, it's the main thing that's been happening is obviously trying to get the aircraft ready for the new season. The new engine has been working out very well on the Swordfish. However, we're still going through the clearance process with the piston. Yeah. So it's been quite an entertaining time. But the Swordfish will be out again this year at the Mark 1, which is great. She's celebrating 75 years this year, and it's actually 80 years in service as well with 825 Squadron, which is flying the Wildcat as well. So overall, it's a very exciting year. Also, we've got 75th anniversary of Bismarck, which is actually today on the 26th of May.
Right,
so,
as we record this.
Indeed, as we record this. So it's amazing to on that side. So yes, it's great to have the Swordfish back up and running again into its next season and a second year for this one flying properly again.
She ground run yesterday. How did she do?
No, very, very well indeed, yes. Yeah. So what we're doing at the moment, we're having to inspect pistons and so forth. So we take it apart every 15 hours and put it back together again and just do an hour's run. So the only thing that happens is obviously when you run for an hour, it gets hot. So I think they shut down halfway through and then went on. But the other good thing is they tested the other systems. They're all working. So, you know, once we get the nod, we're away.
Okay. So. And what is the plan for away? What's the next steps for getting her in the air and all the accreditations you need?
Indeed. So, yeah. So air test will be the next thing. Si Wilson, he's the lead Swordfish pilot. He's been flying here for quite a number of years. And he's nearly got 100 hours in her, which is great. So he will do the air test. And then once he's back from that, providing there's no other surprises and we don't need another air test, we're then into I'll get back into her again and then fly, and then we'll work each other down into the public display with the Commodore or Admiral, and then once that's there, we're into our air show routine and going away. So we're hoping that this will all happen in time for Shuttleworth, which is a Navy Days on the 5th of June, which is going to be great.
Busy time.
It's an exciting time, but you know, we're looking forward to doing it all very, very properly and safely, but secondly to getting her back in the air, because you know, when we're in it, it's such a privilege.
And what about the second Swordfish, which always was the first Swordfish?
The Mark 1 is actually the oldest one. So 326, the white one, she's waiting for an engine. It's always been trying to find the bits for the engine. Now obviously Pegasus 30s aren't exactly a common engine. They were at the, obviously of the era, and actually they were powered about half the, you know, the civilian aircraft at the time, so they're very popular. It's just trying to maintain them now in the 80-90 years later. Second one is waiting for its engine. That's coming online. The Navy's putting more effort into it as well, in the sense that we're trying to get a better production system working, so that in time, you know, and I was hoping obviously that we would have done with the first and the second engine now, but what will happen is at the end of this year, that engine on the Swordfish now will disappear off into servicing, and we'll get the second one out, and then we'll hopefully get a second one back quite quickly, and then we're into flying both.
Okay. But, and what about the other aircraft in the?
At the moment, the Sea Fury FP11 behind me is obviously looking very, very nice. Unfortunately, following the engine failure at Cold Rose in 2014, they went and had a look at the engine and tried to work out what went wrong. And from a flying point of view, I'm not worried about the engine. Yes, it destroyed itself, but it kept going, kept going with so much wrong with it. It had no right to. So it's a testament to the engine. So they said at the time it'll either be a very quick this went wrong, or we're on the slow right lane. We actually turned out in the slow lane, but that's coming to a conclusion now. Once that concludes, then we're in a position of working out whether we need to look at this this engine again or not.
Yeah.
We might have to do a strip and rebuild because it's now been 5 years, but we're also getting the T20, the one that had the engine failure. That's in the process of rebuild. So it won't make this year into air show, but it might be in a position, you know, we don't know what we don't know with the engine yet, but if it, you know, if we have a fair wind and all the rest of it, then the engine will work this year and we'll fly it this year. It, otherwise, we're looking into 17. But at the moment, I'm really looking forward to see that coming back. And each time, it's being rebuilt at North Weald, so it's great acing the plane coming back together again. It is a whole aeroplane similar to the FE11. The engine is in many, many intricate little pieces which allow you to see, wow, that's amazingly how that engine works. So yeah, it's great to see.
And how do you keep current, and what are you flying at the moment to keep yourself going?
Yeah, myself and the other pilots, we maintain currency on the Chipmunk. It's a tail dragger, so it has all the same effects that the big ones do, albeit without the same power. So it's maintained currency on the Chipmunk, and then it's we also are very lucky to borrow a Texan, or the UK built them as a Harvard, which is the right aircraft for training people into it. So the Americans would have had this aeroplane, and you could basically put anyone to it and put them into a Spitfire, Hurricane, Mustang, whatever it may be. So we utilise that as a sort of like a everything in the Chipmunk, test you in the Harvard, and then we're back into the aeroplanes.
And where does the Harvard come from?
This one is from Tim Manners' stable, which is great, which is where the Seafire came from last year as well. And, so he's lent it to us for a little bit just to do this sort of training in. And she'll be living as of July time this year back at Shuttleworth. So.
Right, okay. Well, Chris, all the very, very best for this season. And let's hope we see all these aircraft back in the air very soon.
Yeah, indeed. And it's, as always, the most important thing is the privilege of going out and showing what the history of the Navy and the Fleet Aerum as such. It's great to be involved with it. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm with the commanding officer of the Commando Helicopter Force, Captain Niall Griffin. Captain Griffin, welcome to Extended.
Hi, very good to see you.
Thank you very much for taking some time out. I know you're very busy. Last time I was here was for the retirement of the Jungly Sea Kings. How's that transition to the Merlin gone?
It's gone really well. It's been a really challenging couple of years to get it to go ahead. As you said, last time I saw you, it was quite an emotional day saying cheerio to the Sea King. I've been on the Sea King all of my career, so sort of say it was quite an emotional day. But to see the future capability coming in over the last couple of years, with the aircrew and engineers training to operate and maintain the aircraft, they've really got to grips with it, and they got to grips with it really quickly. And the new capability, the new helicopter, is a significant step forward for both us and three commando brigade who are here to support.
Right, okay. And what sort of differences does the Merlin bring that the venerable Sea King didn't have?
It's quite simple, really. It's quicker, it goes further. It's smoother for the troops in the back. It doesn't shake nearly as much as the Sea King used to, but further and quicker and a greater payload, so we can take more troops in each aircraft as well.
Right. I think we talked about flying the Sea King last time and the differences. What's the Merlin like to fly?
It's great from the pilot's perspective. The aircraft, as I said, is very smooth to operate, but the actual up, down, left, right, backwards and forwards bit is really similar. Most helicopters are. Yeah. But the avionics package with the 21st century helicopter that the Merlin is superb. So the helicopter will do a lot more for you and is a lot more capable in all weathers, all terrains than the Sea King was.
Right.
So it is a really capable helicopter for the pilots to fly. We've also clearly got the two crewmen down the back. We used to have one in the Sea King, but we need two for the Merlin. It's a much larger aeroplane and much more capacity in the back. So we've got the two crewmen in the back there to operate the aircraft fully as a crew.
Right, so crew resource management, as they describe it as, is maybe a little bit more complicated in the Merlin.
Subtly, but the roles are exactly the same. We'll have one of the crewmen operating exactly as they would have done in the Sea King, talking to the pilots and helping them with the routine duties and the navigation and the fighting the aeroplane. And another one sort of focused on the troops, because there are going to be that many more troops in the back of the aircraft.
Right, okay. So what's the future for the CHF here at Yeovilton?
Well, we've always been here at Yeovilton, of course. It's just that we brought everybody back from RAF Benson, having moved on to the Merlin aircraft. And also, not forgetting, of course, 847 Squadron children on the new Wildcat helicopter. So we've always been here. It's just building the Commando Helicopter Force back up to the levels that we were here in 3 or 4 years ago. In terms of the future, it's away from the last dozen years or so, I suppose, of operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, and moving forward into a significantly more maritime-focused era, I think, and certainly with the Queen Elizabeth Carrier program, which will be a fundamental part of in the littoral manoeuvre role.
Right, okay. So let's talk a little bit about Air Day. What's the CHF going to, what presence is it going to have on Air Day?
As ever, the finale, the jungly assault. The Merlin will clearly be involved, as it was a little bit last year. The Wildcat of 847 Squadron will be involved as well as Army Apache, who we take under command whenever we go on operation somewhere. Right, okay. So right and proper that they're part of what we're doing as part of the Commando Helicopter Force assault at the end of the day. In terms of what they're actually going to deliver, that would be giving the game away, and you'll have to come along to watch it.
And what goes into organising that event? Because it is the finale, and we talk about it every year, and everyone really enjoys all the fireworks and the bangs and the flying. What's involved in setting that up?
I'll give that to one of the more junior lieutenants on one of the squadrons to run. It's a great task for them to get to grips with.
Different one every year, is it?
It is. It's because of the churn of people taking over. But it's a great part of a showcase of exactly what we do day in, day out on training exercises and operations. So in terms of practicing it, it's what we do all the time. So it isn't particularly complicated. Mm. That said, clearly they need to make sure that everything is safely delivered and appropriate for a crowd rather than an exercise or an operation. So there are lots of nuances and intricacies of it which need to be sorted out. So it takes a good couple of weeks of training and practice to make sure it's ready to go for Air Day.
Right, well, we're very excited about it. Captain Griffin, thank you very much for taking some time out.
Pleasure.
Well, Tim, that was the first Commodore I got to speak to. Lovely man, John Prentreath, of course, OBE, talking about getting kids involved and the importance to the fleet air arm of that display. But the key talking point for me was talking to Commander Mitchell. Of course, he's wings for the day. And I posed the question to him about the Shoreham air display, and he talked about they're much more stringent. It's MAA, it's not CAA, and the fact that their setup is always based very much on those high energy aircraft, and so therefore they're better prepared, I suppose, to deal with, I hate to use the term, but the aftermath and the fallout from that. And although we haven't had the final reports, the effects are kicking in. But hopefully not too much on Air Day. We talked about RIAT a little while ago. Do you think there'll be any impact there?
I wouldn't have thought so. I think, RIAT, obviously, much bigger venue. Fairford, it's got countryside around it.
It's quite rural, isn't it?
It's the kind of place where a B-52 can rock up and miss the airfield and kind of go overfly the wrong airfield as they did 1 year. What was that for? they've got plenty of space there. I haven't seen anything that would. Suggest that. I suppose also, you've got the things like the Royal Navy Historic Flight. You've got things like Swordfish, which is probably in danger of having a bird strike from behind. there's no high energy problems with that. A lot of the other stuff, maybe helicopters. They have no problem in keeping within a certain display zone, since the sort of Sea Harrier kind of retired. So it'd be interesting to sort of see when the F-35 comes into service, where there'll be air days there with the F-35 with a Navy pilot, and then.
Well, certainly the Commodore hinted that there's a bright future for Yeovilton. They're looking forward to the arrival of the F-35 there. But, we talked about Farnborough earlier. If you feel that Farnborough is not for you, look at RIAT. but certainly look at Air Day 2016. You know, we report every year. Now, sadly, I will not be going to Air Day this year, which is why we're bringing you this content now. I was lucky enough to get down to Yeovilton to talk to this team. I was only one of two people allowed in at the time to get these interviews, so a very big very big thank you to the team there, and particularly to Tracy Clemson for that. So sadly we're not going to be there, but it's a fantastic show. If you want to see a lot of aircraft displaying, the Red Arrows will be there. There's also the Polish display team, which is an Air Day debut. The Royal Jordanian Falcons will also be there. The French are back as well with the Rafael. They've got a pair coming along. B-17 is going to be there. And, of course, as we always talk about, the Jungly Assault. It's the last year for the Lynx as well. So there'll be a display by those, and you'll see the Wildcat, which, of course, will take over. So thank you very much to Tracy and the team at Yeovilton for the opportunity to get down and bring you this content. And we hope that you will be able to go out and support Air Day. Sadly, I cannot be there. So do send us your photos, do send us your tweets and messages. We'd love to know how you got on. Okay, after the break, we're going to talk to Lewis Gaylard about his new book, and it's called Sea Vixen XP-294. And of course, that's all about the Sea Vixen's inaugural year with the Fly Navy Heritage Trust.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
I'm with Lewis Gaylard, aviation photographer and journalist. Lewis, welcome to Extended.
Hello there, thank you very much.
Lewis, we're going to talk about Foxy Lady and the Sea Vixen. But first, I just want to learn a little bit more about your background, because you're linked to Yeovilton, aren't you?
I am, but through family links. Obviously, my first time to Yeovilton was for my 10th birthday, so quite a few years ago now. And my parents brought me, because I lived locally, and they brought me to the Fleet Air Arm Museum. And just after that, obviously, when I came out, my father took me around to the other side of the airfield to watch the flying. And so that was when my love of aircraft kind of began. You know, I remember like yesterday seeing a Sea Harrier for the very first time, you know, hovering in midair in front of you. And yeah, it was great. But my actual family links was my grandfather, who was a timber thrower and worked for a local company called Yandals. And he actually cut all the trees down here back in the late 38, early 39, so the airfield could be built.
Yeah.
And then my great-uncle was actually the site foreman of when the airfield was built.
Yeah.
And then my uncle, Tony Vivian, he worked at Western Helicopters for 41 years, I think it was, as a metallurgist, and then became an aircraft inspector. And so he worked on aircraft from the Westland Wyvern right through until the second prototype of the EH-101, which is now obviously the Merlin. Yeah. So that's kind of my connections.
And we can hear the Merlins working away in the background. You do spend a fair bit of time here, though, don't you?
I'm quite lucky through my work and obviously living local that I write quite a few articles about the Royal Navy and the Fleet Air Arm, the work they do. And obviously at the moment, people probably will realise that the actual Fleet Air Arm as a whole is going through a big transition phase with aircraft types going out of service. Obviously, recently, as you know, the Sea King Mark IV went out of service. So now we've got the Merlin IHC-3 at the moment, which will be eventually the Mariner's Mark IV. And obviously, the Link Mark VIII is due to go out of service next March, I believe. And then obviously, that will be replaced by the Wildcat.
Yeah.
And obviously, the big one coming in for in the next few years is the F-35. So
very exciting.
It's very exciting times for the Fleet Air Arm. I mean, you know, they've had quite a few years of aircraft, you know, through various defence cuts and that. Obviously, that big one was the Harrier and losing a lot of their big ships like the Ark Royal and that. So, Yes, hopefully now is a positive time for them.
Right, OK. Well, that behind-the-scenes activity has given you a unique insight to Foxy Lady. And you've produced a book, haven't you?
I have, yes. It's called Sea Vixen XP94, the inaugural year with the Flying Navy Heritage Trust.
Right, OK. And that will be out... it'll be out now. And tell us a little bit about how you got to get behind the scenes. There's some fantastic pictures, unique... air-to-air shots, photographs of the aircraft in maintenance and in flight. Tell us how you got to do that, and more importantly, why?
Well, the chief engineer of the Sea Vixen team, Brian Johnston, MBE, I'd known for a few years because those in the know, he was quite prominent on the Sea Harrier. And had been in the Fleet Air on, I think, from the mid-late 60s right through until early 2000s. And so, obviously, when he became the chief engineer on the Sea Vixen, he asked me if I was interested in, you know, doing some photography, yeah, you know, with the idea of a book. But the actual book itself, my kind of idea was to kind of take the reader to behind the scenes to areas that they don't... Yeah. They wouldn't normally have the access. Yeah. So, as you rightly say, in the book, there's a lot of engineering photographs which concentrates on, you know, like engine changes, ejection seats being taken out. I'm just trying to think off the top of my head now. Obviously, one of the problems that, or one of the things that happened to the Vixen was when it landed here back in 2014 in September for the handover ceremony, afterwards, when they gave it an inspection, they actually found that the left side aileron had actually failed.
Right.
So that was a big job to actually reskin it and actually, you know, then have it obviously functioning on the aircraft. So photographs of that sort of thing, hopefully, gives a good understanding of the amount of work that actually has to go into maintaining these kind of aircraft. So,
and the aircraft itself, it's not owned by the Historic Flight, is it? Tell us a little bit about that structure and how that works. Yeah. Who looks after it? Who owns it?
Well, obviously, back in September 2014, it was very generously handed over from previous owner, Julian Jones, who was based in Bournemouth Airport. So now, officially, it's actually owned by Naval Aviation Limited, which is a subsidiary company of the Flying Navy Heritage Trust.
Right.
And obviously, a sister of the Royal Navy Historic Flight. So, obviously, both of those are... funded by the Flying Navy Heritage Trust. So,
and the book, tell us the purpose of the book. It's to support the trust and keeping the good lady in the air.
Absolutely, yeah. The profits from the book will go directly to keeping Sea Vixen in the air, obviously, because, as everybody will appreciate, running any sort of aircraft is not cheap. So, so hopefully the supporters, and there's many thousands of them, and the support is growing by the day, I hope they'll buy millions of copies.
Well, it's a lovely, colourful book. There's some fantastic photos in there, some unique photos. Photogenic anyway. I think there is that going for her, but there's some great photos in there. What's the future look like for Foxy Lady?
It's actually looking quite positive. I mean, obviously, it's got a very good support system, the actual aircraft itself. I mean, the engineers, I mean, obviously, I've mentioned Brian Johnson, but obviously, you've got the avionics engineer, Terry Witt, who's got lots of experience behind him, Phil Thornton, another engineer. So they're, you know, they put a lot of time and effort into, you know, maintaining it to a very high... And obviously, the CAA, their standards are very high.
Yeah, she's a CAA-registered aircraft. She's not military, is she?
No, she's CAA aircraft, so... Yeah. And obviously they set very high standards and very strict. So, yeah, and obviously the aircraft is maintained very, very well. So,
and it is down to some of those unsung heroes behind the scenes. Who else has been involved?
Yeah, obviously the display pilot is Commander Simon Hargreaves, OBE, Royal Navy Reserve, which is kind of funny, again, because I've known Simon since I was about 11, back when he was flying Sea Harriers and the commanding officer of 899.
Right.
Because we lived in the same village and we played cricket together, so again, that's a nice link to have. But there's also people like Dawn Stokes, who runs on Facebook the Foxy Lady, Sea Victim Foxy Lady page, and she's been a supporter and an active fundraiser of the aircraft for many, many years.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the Sea Victim is her baby, you know. So, again, you know, she's another one who, you know, needs a lot of praise, actually, for the time and effort she voluntarily puts in. So,
yeah. Well, it is down to those people that we get to see this wonderful aircraft fly. And down to yourself, you know, there's a massive amount of effort that you've put into that book. How long did it take to write?
The actual putting it together, probably about 5-6 months.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, the style of the book, when you see it, it's not a highly technical word. It's not a massively heavy word count on it. But even saying that, it's obviously because I've been taking photographs of the Sea Vixen since September 2014, right through until the end of last year. And obviously, again, it's a lot of photos to go through. And I'm kind of going through that stage now of, I guess, like a lot perhaps other writers or journalists go through, of when you have something published, you know, oh, did I choose to write photos? You know, have I worded these things correctly? Yeah. You know, is it interesting? So I'm hoping that the photos I've selected are not only interesting to me, but obviously interesting to the people who read it, obviously, because I've seen the photos before. So,
well, if you want to support Foxy Lady, do go along to the Facebook page, do follow them. But more importantly, do see if you can get a copy of this book. Proceeds go to keeping her in the air, and we look forward to many years of seeing her fly again. So, Lewis, thank you very much for joining us.
No problem at all. Thank you very much.
Not met Lewis too many times. A lovely guy. Great photos in the book, Tim. I also noticed that Gareth and the team at Global Aviation Resource have covered her as well, and we're going to put some links in the show notes to their report. But the Sea Vixen, she's a lovely lady. She's becoming a real stalwart of the display season. Early as we are, she's ripping up the skies. Fantastic sound. Have you seen her yet?
I've seen her somewhere. Now, where did I? I'm trying to think back. But interesting, I was having a conversation in the office today with a colleague who is ex-Hatfield and Hatfield.
Right.
And they had like open day. I think they about sort of like, you know, their sort of 80s. We're going back to here. And apparently, a Sea Vixen turned up to that.
Wow.
And made everyone kind of drop their sandwiches and just look up there and go, wow. I think it's, you know, it's I really, you know, kind of, it still looks a little bit sort of futuristic, doesn't it?
It does. It's an offset cockpit. It's just a bit, yeah, it does. Yeah, it does look futuristic.
You're not going to mistake it for kind of for anything else. And, you know, the other thing that sort of strikes me out there is the, you know, the sheer, let's say, I'm trying to think of a polite word here, guts of the observer who is in the cold hole. You know, you haven't got, unlike a kind of a phantom or anything like that, you know, you're not, all you've got is kind of a basic skylight. You know where the pilot's going to, you know, put the thing, and to be in that, you know, stuck down in that kind of, you know, sort of nav stroke WSO's position. You know, especially like carrier landings and carrier takeoffs.
Couldn't have been very pleasant. You certainly got to have big kahunas for that.
Unbelievable, yeah. I mean, probably the scariest job in the Navy.
Yeah, well, Foxy Lady, she's a wonderful aircraft. It's a great book. Lewis, well done for putting that together with the team at the Fly Navy Heritage Trust. As we said there, proceeds from the book do go to support the trust. So it's well worth buying. Fantastic photos. It's a lovely coffee table book. So do go out there and support the trust. There's still plenty to come. After this break, we get to your feedback, promoting aerospace, aviation books, and our competition.
Not another flying magazine. The news agents are stuffed with them. How can the aviation historian possibly be any different from the rest? Well, for a start, it's not a monthly, but a quarterly. It's compact format, not the usual A4, so it's great for reading in bed, in the bog, or in the bath. It doesn't cover the same old subjects, but tells you stuff you didn't already know. It's designed simply so it's easier to read, with no fussy backgrounds or overlapping images. And it's not in the newsagents at all. So check the website, theaviationhistorian.com, for more info. The Aviation Historian. It really is different from the rest.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
And so to the get involved and feedback section of the show, three programmes in the last month or so, so a bit to get through. Going back to episode 58 on photography, Ian Kershaw writes, Peter and the crew continue to thoroughly enjoy your efforts, thank you. Last episode included reference to the FOGA. Bud Granley does aerobatics in one on the show circuit in Canada. He also does a dual show with a Yak 18 and a Yak 55. His son flies the red one, Bud the four-seater. His Yak 55 is over 50 years old. Bud, well, he is 77. He also does a great show in a P-51 and a Harvard, and pretty well could fly aerobatics with a powered barn door. As for the top 10 trainers, maybe not ab initio, but the Lightning T5 and the Hunter trainers just look so good with the side-by-side cockpits. I can't disagree with that, Tim.
You're not going to turn a flight in a Lightning T5 down, are you?
No. He then goes on to say, on the MiG-29, I recall some 20 years or so ago, Maxi Gainza wrote about his flight to the heavens. Great piece in Pilot magazine, I recall. Points I remember, the size of the engines, turbine temperatures, limited height. No boots the right size, so he flew in his trainers. He reckoned it was worth losing his feet for. And lots of mastic sealing the cockpit windows. Oh, and the vodka. All the best, and thanks to you all for your time and effort you put into the show. I may be well and truly on the ground, but with you folks, I can sure saw Ian Kershaw. Ian, thank you very much for that note. Tim, a FOGA Magister doing aerobatics. Have you seen anything like that?
I've got to look this up now. it was a display team sort of favourite, wasn't it? From the French, yeah. And I think the Belgians used to fly it as well. So yeah, now these things are in private hands. I guess there's still one or two there out on the Escher circuit.
Yeah, what about the MiG-29? Did you have lots of mastic sealing the cockpit windows?
I remember there was a big vodka debrief.
All right, so you did have the vodka debrief.
Yeah, there's lots of toasts going on.
Right, okay. Well, let's move on then. Dave Homewood on the same episode says, regarding the X10 top 10 for episode 57, what about the chipmunk flying spy flights in Berlin during the Cold War? What is meant by the Harvard as a Boeing heritage aircraft? The de Havilland Tiger Moth was also built in New Zealand, where thousands of pilots were trained under the EFTS scheme. Post-war, many still serving right up until 1956. One still remains with the Royal New Zealand Air Force historic flight. Also in 1942, many of the Air Force's Tiger Moths were also fitted with bomb racks, like the UK ones you mentioned, when it was thought the Japanese were about to invade. They would have been flown by the instructors in the FAI squadrons. I'll have to ask Dave what that is. An emergency measure that would have come into force if the balloon went up, and would also have involved squadrons of Oxfords and Vincents from the training schools defending New Zealand alongside the regular operational squadrons. Of course, the Hawk would never beat the Tiger Moth. The Tiger Moth was built in several countries and operated in many countries. It trained so many pilots in so many air forces, navies and armies around the world, as well as thousands of aero clubs. It also became a crucial aircraft in the development of the aerial top dressing industry in New Zealand and elsewhere, amongst so other many uses. So what has the Hawk done to beat that? Not much. So did the Soviets and the Germans not make any trainers? Gosh, few challenges there, Tim.
Well, thanks for all those questions, Dave. Okay, so the Chimung flying spy flights in Berlin during the Cold War, that was the BRICSMIS. It was kind of a legal spying agreement between West and East. And on the ground, there were people in cars, fast cars, running around with cameras in East Berlin and East Germany, and vice versa, trying to take pictures of interesting-looking sort of Soviet or East German tanks,
yeah.
Infantry formations, get pictures of badges, a whole sort of legalized sort of spying kind of operation. But it was quite hairy at times because, you know, if you had a kind of a get-out-of-pass, get-out-of-jail-free card, but you'd still get sort of... the idea was to get as close as possible and to get where you weren't supposed to be. And there was an airborne component to that as well, which was, incredibly, chipmunks flying from, I think it was RF Gatto, and then they could do photographic reconnaissance flights within sort of a radius of 12 nautical miles within the Berlin control zone, in the Berlin air, the Berlin air routes from West Germany to East Germany. And obviously carry a camera on board and see what they can pick up. So, not as pretty glamorous as U2, but they were down kind of quite low.
Pretty effective, yeah. So what we didn't really talk too much about German and Soviet aircraft and trainers. Anyone's sort of trip off the tongue for you, Tim?
I suppose for the Soviet one, you could have the Po-2. The Po-2, I mean, that's a pretty sort of famous, sort of Soviet trainer. But I think with that one, you also, the thing that kind of springs to mind with that is its sort of a role as the sort of in the night harassment with the night witches.
Right, okay.
Germans, I mean, Messerschmitt 108, kind of a fast tourer, also sort of a trainer.
It's a tricky one, but Dave, thanks very much for posing that. Anyone else got any? Do let us know.
And obviously, in the Cold War, the Soviets, post sort of 1945, obviously, they don't have two seat things like the two seat versions of the MiG-15. But
yeah,
it was really kind of sort of after that, it was kind of devolved to Czechoslovakia with the L-29, L-39. Yeah, good points, though.
Thanks very much, Dave, putting us on the spot there. Tom Mercer says, just finished listening to episode 57. Would like to say what a great listen it was. Fascinating discussion about the current climate of aviation publications and the trend of moving online and the challenges that it has. It's an exciting time to be in the industry. Tom is a photographer himself. Without inspiration from people like Rich Cooper, Jamie Hunter and the guys over at Global Aviation Resource, I wouldn't be where I am today with Aviation Highlights. So thanks. So well done, Tom. Seen some of your content. Keep up the good work. We did have an episode on general aviation and we got some lovely comments about the airfields and the aircraft we saw there. But the show afterwards, 59, proved very popular, and that of course was on the XB-70, the Valkyrie. Ian Barber said, great interview, an amazing piece of engineering. Steve Riley said, forget about Concorde back in the air. I want to see the Valkyrie soar amongst the gods. Okay, I do want Concorde too. Ray Davis says, another great episode. Thank you very much, Ray. It's great to hear how passionate Jeanette is about aviation. Jeanette is very passionate. She loves coming onto the show and talking about her babies, her aircraft and her stories. She has, as I mentioned before, released another book on the B-52, which we simply haven't been able to squeeze in. But we will get Jeanette back on the show. We also want to get Joe back as well, curator of the US Air Force Museum and curator of the US Air Force is a very, very strong accolade for somebody to hold. And we want to talk a little bit to Joe about what that meant. So we'll do that hopefully later on this year. Back to episode 59, David Newman said, great, she looks flipping marvellous. And Tumbles said, it's the best looking bomber ever. I think that Tim, the XB70 really got everyone very excited, particularly the pictures and the passion that Jeanette and Joe brought to that episode. It's an unusual one, the XB70. There were only a few. It's a bit like the TSR2, isn't it? Looks fantastic, iconic, but yet really no success.
Well, I mean, it's one of those things that was, I suppose it was, you know, pushed the boundaries too far in a way. You know, so radical and so high flying and you know, just so expensive, I suppose, at the end of it. It was just, you know, even for the US at that point in time, you know, it was something that was that
just too much, and so much politics and that around it. Yeah, but that proved to be a very, very popular episode with everybody. So, as I said, we will get Jeanette and Joe back on the show later in the year. But if you like her content, you like her material, she is an avid writer. And as I said, has just released a book on the B-52, and she's got many, many others. So do go look them up. Okay, carrying on with the feedback, I just want to give a big shout out to Neil Braden. He's been hyper supportive of the program, drumming up supporters, putting emails out, tweets, Facebook messages, trying to get people to come and listen to the show. We really, really appreciate the support you've given us, Neil. So thank you. Thank you very much. It really, really is appreciated. I know Neil's had some challenges over the last couple of months, and I hope some of the aviation content we bring to him helps put a little bit of a smile back on his face. Moving on to space, Dr. Stuart Gray, we had on the show, oh, goodness me, maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago. He says, hi, Aviation Extended crew. I've made a new video and I thought you might like it. Now, we'll post a link to this on our website with the show notes for this. But he writes that, watch this space. It's a little experiment that he's put together. And, of course, Dr. Stuart Gray is from UCL. That's University College London. And he's trying to show people what is going on in Earth orbit. And in this episode, he calls it, he covers all of the satellite launches and newly tracked pieces of debris for May 2016. It's quite riveting to watch. And it's quite amazing to see quite how much debris we're creating just in 1 month. Now, we will get Dr. Stuart Gray back on the show sometime in later on this year to talk about space and talk about space debris. But that really is a great little video to watch. So we put
it's a great visualization. You have to watch that. And, you know, you're just thinking kind of... yeah, well, maybe it's a good job that sort of Tim Peake is coming back tomorrow, because
there's a lot of stuff floating around there. Yeah, and lots of bits and pieces from satellites that we've have recently failed as well. So I was sort of mesmerised by it, and I kept on playing it over and over again. So it's an unusual one. It's but go see for yourself. See what a mess we're creating up there. And to me, it just means how much more challenging it is for all those scientists, physicists, and people at places like NASA and ESA trying to weave their way through it to get our satellites and spacecraft up there, Tim.
Definitely, yeah. Hats off to them.
Yeah. Right, okay, let's talk about books. We've inserted a little piece on books in each of the shows, and we talk about the Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club on Facebook, of course. Their book of the month just recently was The Mosquito, the original multi-role combat aircraft by Graham Simmons. He's also written a book, by the way, on the Valkyrie. Links to his books in the show notes. I think that's a pretty impressive book. Don't know if you've seen that, Tim?
The Mosquito? No.
Yeah, that book, it seems to be drumming up quite a lot of interest. I've not read any of his books before, but that one seems pretty popular.
Add it to my reading list, I think, yeah.
Yeah. What are you reading at the moment then, Tim? Anything?
Yeah, I've got a reading. I picked up a book on Apache over Libya.
Yes.
So that's
by a chap called
Will Laidlaw, Army Air Corps pilot, and how the Army Air Corps went to went to war in over sort of Libya in 2011 on HMS Ocean. Never been done before, never been embarked. They were kind of breaking new ground. Very, very interesting so far I've got. It was a real sort of high threat environment. And, a couple of interesting things there. One, the Apache that didn't have any sort of it's not designed for overwater flight. So if they'd had to ditch, there was a pretty kind of good chance you were going down with the helicopter. The thing was that you had to try and get the canopy off first, open the canopy first before you ditch, which would have been would seem quite tricky. And secondly, also is that the focus in thinking back to now 5 years ago, the focus obviously was fully on Afghanistan. So there's an interesting bit of sort of him kind of going around and trying to get people infused or push for this mission. So go all right, you're going to try this training before Libya breaks out, and it's sort of seen as kind of taking away from the main effort. The main effort is Afghanistan, train, go out, operations in Afghanistan, come back. Recycle back in, and anything else that was sort of like a little bit kind of, well, why do you want to fly over water, or why do you want to go and operate off ships? Ships, we're not in ships in Afghanistan. So that was kind of interesting, quite interesting as well.
And Tim, I did see that. I've seen it come up a few times. Pretty intriguing. I never really thought through the challenges of flying from HMS Ocean. I just assumed because she could carry the helicopter, it wouldn't be much of a challenge. But I suppose, of course, they're just not designed for it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's been sort of proved now, and it's you think, well, okay, well, it's a if you can fit a helicopter on a flat deck, woohoo, you're in business. But there's all sorts of stuff like where do you store the weapons? Are the Hellfires compatible with what the Navy's kind of standards for storage are, etc. Does the does the radio and the electronics and the radar and all the rest of it interfere with the ship's radar and vice versa and all that kind of stuff? And low flying over the sea without lights on NVGs. So it's a pretty capable helicopter anyway, but this sort of thing hadn't been really thought about too much.
Yeah, interesting. I'll have to add that one to my list, I think. I'm reading Testing to Win by previous guest Tony Blackman, and I've got to say I'm really, really enjoying it. I got it as a present, and I put it to one side into the queue. And do you know what, the cover actually put me off a little bit. I thought, I'm not sure about that. And it's funny how covers do that, and I often buy books based upon what I see, but the inside couldn't be any different. Fair cop to Tony and choosing the cover photos. You've got to remember he started his flight training back in the 50s, and he chose some photographs that we wouldn't accept today with the digital standards we've got, but really do sum up the story in the book. And it's his story about how he comes through flying training and through to testing aircraft like the Vulcan. Of course, we spoke to him about that. But he also has a very long section on the Hawker Siddeley 748, which is an aircraft not familiar to most, but I've actually flown on one, and I've got a soft spot for it. And he talks about the various places they took it to and how they competed with the F-27, the Fokker F-27, of course, which used the same Rolls-Royce Dart engines but didn't have the short runway capability that the 748 had. I really, really enjoyed it. He writes it like a story, but there's plenty enough technical detail in there to give any aviation fan a good amount of detail. He also, and this is something I picked up, he writes in very bold paragraphs that he leaves an extra space in between. And again, I thought it looked a bit like a school book when I first picked it up. But what it allows you to do is read it at any time, pick it up, put it down, and the paragraphs are so nicely spaced that you always find your place easily. And it's a silly little thing, but the layout of the book really makes it easy to read. So well done, Tony. I think we'll get you back on the show soon. I know you've been down under a fair bit recently, but what a wonderful book and what a wonderful man.
Definitely. Sounds like there's an opportunity there for an aviation-related graphic designer to do a book cover.
Yeah, that's right. Now, tell us what you're reading. Tweet us, Facebook us, or even email us if you want, and hashtag AvBook, A-V-B-O-O-K. Now, we do have a book competition that is still running. I know some of you have entered it and thought we might well have closed the doors now, but we're going to keep it running for a little bit longer, and that is that we have three copies of Mark Van Honecker's book, that's Skyfaring, to give away. And all you have to do is post a message on our Facebook or Twitter pages and include the hashtags AvBook and hashtag Skyfaring, and we'll put everybody in the hat, and we'll pick three out before our next major episode, so probably in about 3 or 4 weeks time. And a little giveaway is that we've got Mark coming onto the show, so we want to save those, the announcement of the winners, for when Mark's on the show. So good luck to everyone. They're just giving away. You don't have to do anything other than put hashtag AvBook, hashtag Skyfaring, and we'll pick one.
Really, really good book. If you've not read that, or you know, if you're an aviation geek, even if you've got people in the family who are, you know, been going on holiday and they're going on a long-haul flight, really, really well worth reading.
Yeah, it's so well written. It's a fantastic focus on, I don't even know quite how to describe it, Tim. It's such a so well and eloquently written about the life of an airline pilot, but there's a bit of history in there. There's an awful lot of travelogue in there. There's detail in there for if you like your detail. Mark's, of course, a 747 pilot. He came to his career late in life, so he really, really loves his job, and you will not find a better written book than Skyfaring. So highly recommended. Do go out and get it. I noticed also in the airport yesterday it's doing pretty well in the charts, actually, Tim. Excellent. I think it was number 11. Yeah, pretty good. Okay, over to promoting aerospace. Couple of shout outs for some of our sister programs. The Airplane Geeks have just turned 400. Well, I say 400 with one a week. By the time they got that one out, I think we're about 404 now. So congratulations to Max all the team at the Airplane Geeks. So well done. Yeah, 400 episodes. That is amazing. And they still religiously get programs out once a week. And as some of you may know, I did contribute to half of those episodes. I did 200 across the pond segments, but goodness me, it was hard to keep up with those guys. So well done to them. Down under, a big shout out to Dave Homewood. We mentioned him earlier, but he's just released his 100th episode as well, and it's a long episode, and don't be put off by that. There is a pause button, of course, on most players. Put it on your iPhone or your Android phone, listen to it on the train. It's a fantastic collection of some of the interviews he's put together in the first 99 episodes. And if you like warbirds, if you like historic aircraft, you really, really must listen into this. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. Tim, any shout outs?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we've talked already about Farnborough. So, you know, coming up next month. So just a shout out to say the RAS will be there. We'll have a stand. You know, if you are there, come along and see, you know, find out more about the Royal Aeronautical Society. You know, you will have arts people there to tell you about sort of membership, about the lectures, about local branches. There's some exciting stuff promised on the actual stand. I might be kind of a little bit busy and running around looking for news. And also on the Thursday, there's going to be an Amy Johnson lecture or Amy Johnson debate that we're going on. So if you're one of the lucky people who is visiting during the trade days and you're there on the Thursday, might be well worth sort of checking out what's going with the Amy Johnson lecture.
Okay, if you've got an event you want us to promote or some news from your local airfield, email us, get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. Remember, this doesn't have to be in the UK either. We're happy to help promote events all around the world. Little bit of a look ahead then. Tim mentioned Farnborough there. I will be there probably on the Tuesday now, and we'll see if we can pull together an episode or a quick cast from there for you. We will again try and focus on some of those stories behind the scenes, because most of the main stories will be picked up by people like Tim and those other professionals. We'll see if we can look under the skin of Farnborough, get to some of the smaller organisations and aerospace companies there. But what we will have for you, either in that episode or shortly afterwards, is a feature on Boeing's 100th birthday. Very exciting. A riveting interview to come that you did, Tim. So looking forward to that.
Yeah, really, really good.
Yeah, excellent. And also, as I mentioned there, we've got Mark coming onto the show, Mark Van Honecker, and probably one of the most travelled airline people I know as well, for an episode focused on passengers and airlines. So looking forward to that as well. So lots in the pipeline for you into the summer. Maybe later in the summer we might take a few weeks off, but for the moment it's full ahead. Okay, now before we wrap up, we need your help. We've got lots of listeners who have never left us any feedback. If you are on iTunes or any other player, please do us this favour and leave us some feedback, because only by gaining positive comments and stars will these players like iTunes promote our programme. Now, we produce and present this programme. Please take a few minutes to give something back. It really would help us. Okay, we'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. You can download us from this website. There are apps out there to help you as well. Stitcher.com, UKpodcast.com, thepoddirectory.com, and of course iTunes. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. Tim, where can we find you online?
Okay, yeah, I'm on Twitter at RESTimR, and you can find the Royal Aeronautical Society, www.aerosociety.com.
And you can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
But yeah, no, it's great. We're getting the aircraft back in the air again, which has been... should we start again once this helicopter's gone?
Probably a good idea. That was a bit louder than I thought, actually. Okay.
Damn these helicopters, right?
Okay.
Extend it!
This is XTP Media.